dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. America is the freest country in the world. I've heard that statement all my life. We're taught it in school. It's echoed in political campaign rhetoric and repeated by everyday people, very often people who've never been to any other country. If one's life consists of going to work and obeying the orders of your boss, going shopping and paying for your purchases, driving home in a car with all the proper licenses and insurances, to a home on which all the rents, mortgages, and taxes are paid, cooking dinner, watching TV, and going to bed to do it all again tomorrow, even people in dictatorships are free to live that life. Try disobeying your boss, not paying your rent, taking your food without paying the price demanded, or organizing a protest designed to interfere with a major political party convention, and you will quickly come up against the limits to freedom. Middle-class people who fall on hard times learn what poor people have long known. Fail to pay and obey the owners, and you'll soon find yourself behind bars, not free at all. My neighbor is a man who spent his entire adult life depriving people of freedom. He is a prison guard. Meeting him was a revelation to me. I had assumed that people who became prison guards were sadists and bullies, or at best, callous. He is none of those things. He is a kind person who's worked his whole life at a job he hates. He explained that he grew up in a town where he had three options upon high school graduation: work in a factory and be laid off half the year, go to college, but he was not academically inclined, or go to work in the town's major industry, the prison. What kind of free country has towns where the majority of its residents derive a livelihood by depriving others of freedom? He married a beautiful woman with expensive tastes, had kids, got divorced when she traded him in for a new model. My neighbor has spent his entire work life waiting for retirement, now only a few years away, making it through only with the help of alcohol, an irony he himself noted since he works keeping people caged for partaking of other pain-lessening but illegal substances. He told me that the average prison guard spends 11 years inside a prison when you add up all the hours. The rhetoric of law and order politicians portrays prison as a place necessary to protect us from dangerous people, murderers, rapists, and so on. But most of the people who end up behind bars in the freest country in the world, which has more people jailed than any other country, more than 2 million right now, are people who simply don't have enough money. It's easy to end up in jail. Here in New York State, one is required to buy insurance on one's car and to pass a yearly inspection of the car at a certified garage. Driving without these things leads to fines assessed by the day and a suspension of one's license. Unless you're one of the few who lives within walking distance of work, you need a car because there's almost no public transport. You may be told during your inspection that your car requires $700 worth of work to pass, as once happened to me. If you don't have a credit card to whip out, or it's already maxed, you will find yourself with a Hobson's choice. drive to work illegally in the hope of getting enough money to fix the car, or don't drive, lose your job and everything else. I have known law and order Republican Christian fundamentalists who became criminals in just this way. If you're caught driving, you'll be levied a fine you can't pay, which will result in a warrant for your arrest, and you'll likely end up in jail if you don't have friends or family who can lend you money. If my neighbor had become bitter and sadistic, taking out his misery on his captives, it would hardly be surprising. That so many people are vicious is hardly surprising. It is a testament to the human spirit that so many are not. It is not surprising that religions promising an afterlife are popular when fulfillment in this life has been stolen from so many so a few can live well. Why is it that in the world's greatest democracy, it is considered axiomatic that you can't fight City Hall? The one thing I want to accomplish by doing this radio show is the communication of a simple truth. Everything about our society is the product of human decision, and we can make other decisions. We can fight City Hall. We can take it over. We can raise it to the ground. Suppressing this knowledge is the mission of the institutions of so-called American democracy. That is why, among other things, I'm pleased to continue with our reading of the book, Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, which will continue in the second hour. One might ask, well, what about me? Don't I broadcast a show with all these radical ideas and no one's carting me off to jail as they would in some place like China or Turkey? Sure, there are places less free, but on the other hand, you don't hear Susan Rosenthal being interviewed on the NBC Nightly News. If radical ideas start to develop a broad audience, then the state steps in. We'll begin the show by hearing a documentary about the life of Emma Goldman, a woman jailed and ultimately expelled from the United States for talking.
Every daring attempt to make a great change in existing conditions, every lofty vision of new possibilities for the human race has been labeled utopian. The woman who originally said these words is our subject this week on From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. And who is the speaker of those words? Emma Goldman, quite possibly the most famous anarchist this country has ever produced. We're using as the foundation for this week's program The Courage to Struggle, a wonderful documentary produced by Tish Valva in 1991.
Emma Goldman was asked, "When did you become an anarchist, and what made you one?" She smiled and slowly smoothed her book upon her knee. "We are all egotists," she answered. "I am an anarchist because I am an egotist. It pains me to see others suffer. I cannot bear it. So, because what others suffer makes me suffer, I am an anarchist and give my life to the cause, for only through it can be ended all suffering and want, and unhappiness." Emma Goldman was born in June 1869 in the Jewish quarter of Kovna, a small city in what is now Lithuania. She experienced a tumultuous childhood. Her father's failures in business, the early death of his oldest son, and growing anti-Semitism in Russia caused the family to move frequently. Her father was prone to violent fits of anger and often took them out on Emma. At an early age, Emma knew she had to escape the turmoil of her family life. While living with her family in St. Petersburg, she experienced some of the excitement of the early revolution, the nihilists, and the early fights against the Tsar. She was excited by the political life of St. Petersburg, but she was destined to a marriage arranged by her father. At the age of 16, she and her sister decided to opt instead for the promise of America. Candace Falk has spent the last 15 years working on Goldman's history. She is the author of Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, a biography, and is the editor and director of the Emma Goldman Papers.
She and her sister, Helena, left on board a ship, the Gellert, to go to the United States. They landed in New York and went up to Rochester, where she had another sister. And in Rochester, she experienced something that surprised her, which was that the factory life that she had known very well in Russia at the time, what she found so oppressive, was actually less oppressive than what she met in Rochester. In Rochester, she found that she worked in factories that were very repressive in terms of the workers couldn't sing while they worked, they couldn't talk with each other. And all the hopes that she thought that she would find, all the freedom that she looked forward to, was blocked by the struggle for economic survival and by class differences that were even apparent among the Jewish community, where she had been running away from anti-Semitism in Russia. Here she found a different kind of oppression even within her own community. She was attracted to a young garment worker who also seemed to love to travel and have an interest in having a life outside of the immigrant community, and married him, and was very disappointed in that marriage because he really couldn't meet her as an equal. Well, as it comes when you read somebody's autobiography and work with their letters so much, you know so much about them, including that their sexual life was really not commensurate to what she had hoped for. And according to Emma, he was impotent and very humiliated by it, and tended to lose himself in gambling and card playing. And that life seemed so barren to her that eventually she left him. And leaving somebody at that time was a very shocking thing, to have a divorce in a immigrant community. And her own analysis of why she left him was that she started to hear the voices of the freedom fighters around her, who were willing to sacrifice anything for freedom and for a vision of a world that was better than the one that they lived in.
Meanwhile, laborers in Chicago rallied for an 8-hour workday. On the fourth day of a general strike in 1886, a bomb exploded in Haymarket Square, killing one policeman and injuring many citizens. 8 of the demonstrators were arrested and 7 were hanged for the death. It was clear, however, that they were really tried for their political beliefs. This incident gave Emma the impetus she needed to move to New York and dedicate her life to fighting for freedom. She lived cooperatively with friends and soon became well known as a lecturer.
She spoke at a time when it was very common for people to go out almost every night to lectures to hear what people had to say. And so she began her political career speaking to different audiences. And then eventually she had her own magazine called Mother Earth Magazine, which was a forum for political and social issues of the day. It began in 1906 and went to 1917.
At that point, a period of repression swept the nation. The government made an attempt to crush the anti-militarism movement. It also tried to crush the IWW and other labor movements and activities. The post office suppressed Mother Earth magazine by blocking its mailing privileges. Free speech advocates on the staff quickly published a new magazine called the Mother Earth Bulletin, but it was suppressed. Next, showing great ingenuity, they published a journal called Instead of a Magazine, and it, too, was banned. Hundreds of magazines were suppressed in this manner. For Goldman, these magazines, combined with her lecture tours, served as vehicles to speak to people about the 8-hour workday, freedom of expression, birth control, the modern drama, about open education, conscription, women's rights as equals both in the labor movement and at home, about prostitution, and about many international movements for freedom.
Many times when she was about to speak in a town, the landlord would be threatened by the police, saying, if you allow Emma Goldman to speak in your hall, you will lose your license. They were threatened, and very often she would come to a hall and there would be a lock on the door. And although Goldman's ideas were quite ahead of her time, she still was the kind of person who looked straight into the fire and spoke the truth about what was happening and was willing to challenge the existing status quo. And people wanted to support her right to do that. And so very often, whether people agreed with her or not, they would form free speech clubs to say, well, I may not believe with him of Emma Goldman's opinion on free love and against marriage, but she has a right to speak her mind. So now, when you look back at Goldman's talks and the kind of public life that she led, what's very important to see is that both her ideas were compelling, and also the fact that there was a political struggle around her ability to express her ideas that left a lasting effect on American history. Because certainly the early struggles for freedom of speech in this country were based on women like Emma Goldman, and particularly people who were marginalized or more victimized as anarchists, who were easier targets for government and police repression.
Anarchism has no set rules, but there is one principle it teaches which is fundamental, and that is the imperative duty of direct action on the individual. For instance, take the matter of 80 cent gas. When the collector comes with his bill made out at the $1 rate, pay him only 80 cents. And if he protests, politely throw him downstairs. If all of you did that, the gas company would soon come to the conclusion that 80 cents is all it can expect. The real trouble is that you think you cannot get along without the gas company, when the fact is the gas company cannot get along without you.
Roger Baldwin, who was one of the founders of the American Civil Liberties Union, says that he owes his entire inspiration to Emma Goldman, who had the courage to speak out and really reminded him that the key issue was the issue of liberation from coercion.
In an interview with Marsha Mint Dinab in 1973, Roger Baldwin reflected on Emma's lectures.
When she did speak, whether it was a small group or a large one, she was so positive and so sure of herself and reasonable, always very reasonable, and sometimes humorous. She was what you call hard-hitting. Mm-hmm. And she held attention of her audience all the time because of that. You never knew quite what was coming next. She wouldn't put anybody to sleep. She was very quiet on the platform, but very positive. And she didn't raise her voice. She didn't shout. She didn't use any gestures. She just talked very simply, very positively, and very coherently. She went right along. She was a good speaker, not a great orator. She was a very convincing speaker, too.
Free speech means either the unlimited right of expression or nothing at all. The moment any man or set of men can limit speech, it is no longer free. Let all reformers and radicals realize, once and for all, that to love liberty means to become lawless, since freedom and law can never harmonize.
Emma's earliest talks were directed at the immigrant community in the Northeast. Soon she had followers in all strata of society. Her lectures on the modern drama were quite popular among the middle class. She was very interested in the way the characters interacted and how these interactions dramatized the principles of freedom. She cited Ibsen and Strindberg and used the modern drama as a vehicle to bring her personal and public life principles together. Many years before, Emma addressed a crowd of the unemployed in New York City's Union Square.
Demonstrate before the palaces of the rich. Demand work. If they do not give you work, demand bread. If they deny you both, take bread. It is your sacred right.
For these words, she was arrested, convicted, and sentenced to a year's imprisonment on Blackwell's Island. When she had completed her sentence, she attended a meeting arranged to celebrate her release.
The New York World reported in its lurid prose that Goldman entered from the left wings and strutted to the front center of the stage. There, dressed in simple black, save for a red ribbon at her neck, she stood with head thrown back and glared up at the roof with her peculiar half-closed eyes. Friends and comrades, I have come back to you after having served 10 months in prison for talking, she proclaimed. If the representatives of your government intend to prosecute women for talking, they will have to begin with their mothers, wives, sisters, and sweethearts, for they will never stop women from talking. But it was not Emma Goldman who was prosecuted. It was the thoughts of Emma Goldman, the principles of anarchy that were prosecuted. It was the right of free speech that was prosecuted. The authorities are afraid of those who try to open the eyes of the people to their sufferings.
Goldman was frequently arrested for speaking her beliefs. In 1916, she was jailed for publicly advocating birth control. She was not afraid to speak directly and forthrightly.
From whatever angle the question of birth control may be considered, it is the most dominant issue of modern times. And as such, it cannot be driven back by persecution, imprisonment, or a conspiracy of silence. Every woman should have the right to say whether she shall have a child or not. Motherhood should be a voluntary act, not the act of a slave.
Emma identified herself as a single woman. She did not believe in marriage or monogamy. In her later years, when Emma had moved to Canada, she lived with the Ladin family in Toronto. Ora Ladin Robbins was 18 at the time and recalls how Emma's views made an impact in her house.
My mother was a marvelous Russian cook, and Emma loved to eat. She enjoyed liquor, and she enjoyed company. She didn't have too much patience with people who didn't agree with her, and she and my mother got along very well. My mother so admired her and worked very hard to raise money for her. The only thing that she didn't adhere to or didn't particularly care for was Emma's thoughts on free love. She thought that might be rather a bad influence for me.
Once in Detroit, Goldman was invited to speak at a union meeting.
Members and friends of Local 127 of the Automobile Aircraft and Vehicle Workers of America, it's a pleasure to be asked to present our speaker this evening. I was going to say that money talks, and we have certainly spoken eloquently tonight, and I suppose that because she is such a good talker, and because she speaks so eloquently, that the first syllable of her name is gold. And because she speaks so vehemently, because she speaks with such authority, the last part of her name is man. I want to introduce Emma Goldman.
Friends, by the introduction of our good chairman, I can see that he is a man. The conceit of the male that when you think deeply and express yourself with intensity, you must be manly and not womanly. I want to tell him that I know any amount of men who neither think nor express themselves in any shape or form. I know that it takes an American man a long time to wake up. But once he wakes up, he is a fighter, and nothing can stop him from fighting for what he considers right.
After a very active period of speaking in the United States, in which she took 6-month tours every year to speak on a variety of subjects, the ones that reached the largest audiences were, of course, the birth control talks of 1915 and 16, and then in 1917, her work against the involuntary conscription of men into the military. And that was so threatening. And the numbers of people who showed for her lectures so extraordinarily large that she was arrested. under this kind of war measures repression, a kind of a treasonous act to speak out against the draft. And we even have a government document at the Emma Goldman Papers from Attorney General Caffey in 1917 that says Emma Goldman is an extremely persuasive woman with persuasive powers so strong as to make her dangerous. She was imprisoned for 18 months, and during that time, the government, particularly J. Edgar Hoover, managed to invalidate her citizenship and get her deported with 249 other radicals, mostly immigrant radicals, and put on a ship, the first ship of deportees, to go back to Russia in 1919.
The young J. Edgar Hoover, before he became the director of the FBI, stood on the docks at 4 o'clock in the morning to watch her boat leave. In her last act of defiance before being deported, it is said that Emma Goldman thumbed her nose at Hoover as the ship sailed away. Goldman had been inspired by the participation of the Russian people in the 1917 revolution there. Although she was looking forward to the promise of this revolution, what she found when she got there were the seeds of suppression, the suppression of dissent, and particularly the suppression of the anarchists. She met with Lenin to bring questions that she had, but she felt disregarded and quite concerned about the future there. After only 2 years, she decided to leave Russia and to write about her experiences and alert the world that, although the dream was still alive, the reality was not.
Was this the revolution I had believed in all my life, yearned for and strove to interest others in? Or was it a caricature, a hideous monster which had come to jeer and mock me? I was no longer deceived by their mask, but my real problem lay much deeper. It was the revolution itself. Its manifestations were so completely at variance with what I had conceived and propagated as revolution that I did not know anymore which was right.
Many of her followers were shocked by her outspoken critique.
There's a description of a talk that she gave in England by Bertrand Russell, in which he says that she came into a room to speak in London. Everyone in the audience stood up and applauded madly for this great heroine and the honor of being in her presence. And then when she spoke critically of the Soviet Union, you could have heard a pin drop after her talk. No one applauded, no one booed, everyone just sat in utter silence. And I think that that was like a metaphor for some of the experiences that she had after she left the Soviet Union.
Goldman decided to write a book. She called it My 2 Years in Russia, but her publisher renamed it My Disillusionment in Russia.
She was quite angry because Goldman, the great visionary, believed that she was never really disillusioned. She then went on to write her own autobiography in the south of France called Living My Life, which is still a tremendous work of literary and political grace and intelligence, and gives you some of the pulsating feeling of what her day-to-day life was and the people who were in it. And of course, there was this kind of poignance to her writing it as an exile, as a woman who could never be that active again.
After leaving Russia, Emma moved around Europe. She wrote that she was a lonely exile and was sad that she could no longer live as lively and as active a life as she had in the United States. In 1934, President Roosevelt allowed her back into the U.S. for a 90-day lecture tour.
Even Eleanor Roosevelt allowed her into the country, and we have a letter at the Emma Goldman Papers that is rather comical, in which someone writes to the government and says, how could you allow that woman back into the country? And Eleanor Roosevelt says, I think the country can handle her. She's a very old woman now, and I think the country can handle her for 90 days. Goldman was not supposed to speak about anything directly political on that 90-day speaking tour except drama. And of course, in her true style, she spoke about the drama of the rise of fascism and Nazism and was really received quite well. But the poignancy of it again was that she couldn't return to the country where her closest comrades were and where the real base of her political work was. Although by this time she was certainly an international figure, she still longed for the America of her youth.
She continued her political activities as best as she could. She was quite active in the Spanish Civil War in 1936, visiting the front several times, risking her life. Working from her post in England, she became the English language propagandist for the CNTFAI, the Anarchist Labor Organization.
They are fighting on because they are the only people in the world who still love liberty passionately enough to be willing to die for it. I should not have believed such a thing possible had I not seen with my own eyes the epic greatness of the Spanish people. Whatever the outcome of the unequal struggle, the contribution they have already made to the greatness of the human spirit will not be daunted, can never die, and never be lost. My work for my Spanish comrades, while bringing but meager results for them, has meant the greatest experience of my public life.
At the end of her life, while living in Canada, Emma raised funds for the Spanish women and children refugees of the war. She continued to write and to support anarchists and other political and literary figures, such as Helen Keller, Paul Robeson, Aldous Huxley, and Albert Einstein. But Emma's brief visit to the U.S. and her activities in Spain did little to alleviate the instability of a life of exile.
It is only now, when most of my friends have gone by the board, and when I myself feel so cast out, pursued by the Furies and nowhere at home, that the love of the few friends I have left has begun to stand out more beautifully than before.
In 1940, while living in Toronto, Emma Goldman suffered a stroke. Goldman had been banished from living in the U.S. for 2 decades. Ironically, her body was finally allowed to return after her death.
Emma Goldman died on May 14, 1940. At the funeral services for Emma Goldman, Harry Weinberger spoke. For more than 30 years, I have known Emma Goldman as her lawyer and her friend. Never in all those 30 years have I known her except as a battler for freedom and justice. She was tireless, she was fearless. She never compromised. Liberty was always her theme. Liberty was always her dream. Liberty was always her goal. In a world of marching feet and tremendous battles, one marcher is missing. One warrior for freedom will struggle no more. Emma Goldman is gone, gone to join that army of men and women of the past to whom liberty was more important than life itself. She spoke out in this country against war and conscription and went to jail. She spoke out for political prisoners and was deported. She spoke out in Russia against the despotism of communism and again became fugitive on the face of the earth. She spoke out against Nazism and the combination of Nazism and communism, and there was hardly a place where she could live. Emma Goldman, we welcome you back to America, where you wanted to end your days with friends and comrades. We had hoped to welcome you back in life. You will live forever in the hearts of your friends, and the story of your life will live as long as the stories are told of women and men, of courage and idealism.
Emma Goldman devoted her life to struggling for women's rights and for workers' rights. It's important not to immortalize her as we celebrate her life, but to join in her spirit as a woman, an anarchist, and a fighter in the struggle for freedom. Goldman's papers were read by writers and activists Judy Berry, Gina Sole, Sarah Crome, Candace Falk, Joanne Lewis, Leon Litwack, Judy Shattuck, Michelle Schacht, Laura Wide, Kay Kaiser, and Sarah Vogan.
For this half hour on From the Vault Remembered, we'll hear an intensive interview with Candace Falk, the director of the Emma Goldman Papers Project and author of the book Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman. The interview, conducted in 1985, deals with the more personal life of Emma Goldman, her loves, her relationships, and how those were affected by her activism, and how her activism was affected by her loves.
Free love, as if love is anything but free. Man has bought brains, but all the millions in the world have failed to buy love. Man has subdued bodies, but all the power on earth has been unable to subdue love. Man has chained and fettered the spirit, but he has been utterly helpless before love. High on a throne with all the splendor and pomp his gold can command, man is yet poor and desolate. If love passes him by, and if it stays, the poorest hovel is radiant with warmth, with life and color. Thus love has magic power to make of a beggar a king. Yes, love is free if it gives itself unreservedly, abundantly, completely. All the statutes, all the courts in the universe cannot tear it from the soil once love has taken root. If, however, the soil is sterile, how can marriage make it bear fruit? It is like the last desperate struggle of fleeting life against death.
Those words were first delivered to the public by Emma Goldman in 1909, an excerpt from her lecture on love and marriage. Emma Goldman, the prominent anarchist of the early 1900s, was a fiery and outspoken critic of marriage, jealousy, and dependency. But the painful details of her 10-year relationship with Ben Reitman, a gynecologist and advocate for the homeless in Chicago, were carefully evaded when she wrote her autobiography, Living My Life. In 1975, Candace Falk, who was the director of the Emma Goldman Papers Project, found hundreds of love letters between Emma Goldman and Ben Reitman. Falk's book, Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, unfolds the stormy Goldman-Reitman relationship. How do you think that the persona which is captured in your book compares with a persona projected in her autobiography?
I think that there's a continuity of the passion and the emotion and the woman who struggled to live for her ideal, her vision of anarchism. So in that sense, there's a lot of continuity. But where my book, Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, breaks from Emma Goldman's own autobiography is that I tell the story of the torment and the weak points as they related to her public life. And I think that Emma Goldman felt much too vulnerable at the time of writing her autobiography to reveal this part of herself to the public. She had hoped that the autobiography might be her ticket back to the United States after her deportation. She was sensitive about the sexual aspects of her life. She enjoyed reveling in an image of herself as a passionate woman, but I don't think that she felt that the public or even her own sense of herself could handle having some of the inner torment of her love life revealed at that time in history. It's interesting to me that in the letters themselves, there's a lot of self-consciousness that she had as a historical figure, where she did want these letters to be public, but not in the context of her own life while she was alive.
Well, she did say to Sasha and her friends when she was going to write the autobiography that she felt it was very important for her to express those parts of herself. Do you think that perhaps Sasha was an influence in having her editorialize some of the things that she might have included?
I think that he was, in fact, although I'm not sure how much she would have included. I had a wonderful experience in Cuernavaca in 1977, visiting some friends of Emma Goldman's, Molly Steimer and Senya Fleshin, who were also in exile, only they were in exile in Cuernavaca. And they told me that when Emma Goldman came back to France, to Saint-Tropez, to write her autobiography, that they were sitting in a cottage with her by the sea, And she had lots of letters strewn all over the table and wanted to really talk through what her autobiography would be and what it would mean. And Molly Steimer and Senya Fleshin and Berkman himself said her autobiography should be a monument to the cause of anarchism and a monument to her own life and contribution to the movement. And people like Ben Reitman should be left out of this book, Ben Reitman being her lover and manager for 10 years and someone who they felt very much disdain for. And one of the more poignant aspects of meeting with Molly Steimer and Senya Fleshin was when Molly Steimer said to me, "You know, Emma felt that I never understood her." She said, because at the end, even when the autobiography came out, she felt that Molly Steinberg said to Emma Goldman, "Well, you included too much about your personal life and too much about your love life and not enough about the cause." And Emma said to Molly Steimer, "Molly, you never understood me. You never understood how much my inner life is part of my public life." And so when I met with Molly Steimer, there was a little bit of discomfort at first. Why was I doing the same thing, only stretching it further? But she did acknowledge to me the part of Emma who also wanted this to be revealed.
Well, it seems clear in her autobiography and just in the book itself that Emma saw an incredible interdependency between her personal life and who she was and her family background, going as far back as that. How does one feed into the other?
Emma Goldman found her own family life quite stifling and really painted in gray tones throughout her life. Her parents had a very loveless marriage in many ways and very turbulent. Her mother was a cold woman to the children at first, and her father also had violent rages. And there was a lot of jealousy and scampering for affection among the siblings and movement from place to place. And her whole image of family was very stifling. And I think that, however, even in her own early life with her family, there were glimmers, there were moments in which she felt something more exalted.
Well, like her sister, Helena.
Like she had her sister Helena, who really gave her the kind of love and attention that she needed. A peasant, Petrushka, who worked with her and played with her, worked with family and played with Emma Goldman at an early age. And I should say her mother was quite a public speaker and a representative for many of the Jewish young boys who were being drafted into the army. In Russia, she was a spokesperson for having them kept out. Her father also was a minor petty official, and so it wasn't like there was no glimmer of public life in her early life. But I think that she felt in her public life that she was overcoming the narrowness of family and leaving this slavery to the nuclear family to give something to the world at large.
One thing I'm curious about, just by what you're saying, is there's a whole conflation of her political beliefs about the family and the institution of marriage and feelings against that. And that, you know, here in this book is portrayed this intense relationship that she has with this man. However, it seems to me that there's always a way in which she distances herself from him, and that she does that in most of her relationships. Do you see that?
Yes, I do. In many ways, I feel like she, like most of us, have their personality and relational personality very much shaped early in life, which is not to say that it can't be changed or modified, but many of the basic patterns in her life, her what she
talked about herself in her autobiography as a feeling of between two fires around men, both repulsion and attraction, I think was true in many relationships in throughout her life, and that she had somewhat of a repetition compulsion, if you can call it that, to repeat the same pattern over and over again, and to feel in many ways like the abused and an abandoned child. And that did repeat itself in her relationships with men and also with some women. And that although she had a tremendous public image and people saw her as almost the lioness of power, and that her own internal sense of herself didn't often match that. But I should say that I think that her issues with intimacy are not alien to anyone who attempts to find love and some kind of consonance and harmony in their life. I think that that's what the appeal of the material is, and of Emma Goldman through this interpretation of her life, because it rounds her out as a human being. It gives her flesh and blood, and shows that no matter what she was able to give to the world, she wanted very much to have something in her own intimate life that didn't often work for her.
I wonder, I don't know how you felt about this. I know when I kept reading about Ben, I disliked him intensely. I mean, I thought he just seemed incredibly contradictory. He seemed obnoxious. He seemed misogynistic in many ways, even though he sort of purported to be something. How was it for you to write about this him?
Well, it's interesting, because in the beginning I had somewhat of the same feeling. Actually, very early on, I couldn't find letters of his. And so there were all these torrid letters from her to him. When I got to know him through his letters, I began to feel that although he was so much of an outcast in her world and was so vulgar and so outrageous in many ways, that he was able to give something to Emma Goldman that nobody else had given her, which was a real affirmation of herself as a woman. Now, he tormented her as a woman also because of his tremendous obsessions, as he called them, his promiscuity. And he was very crude in many ways and very misogynist in other ways. But he had, I felt towards, well, it wasn't even towards the end, I felt a growing sympathy for him as a person who was limited, but who knew his limitations, and who gave what he could. But I came to the material with a certain kind of political understanding and the goal of trying to say something about the ways in which public politics and private politics have certain parallels, something about the plight of women, something about love and anarchy, something about Emma Goldman and making her more human and palatable. And so I think that rather than seeing it as voyeuristic, I think that represents a puritanical that's a puritanical response. And one in which I think many people feel like, my God, I wouldn't want to have my letters public or identify maybe too much. I think that the issues of in the book touch in many different places, and that it's like a coming out of what people's inner lives are like. This is the story of Emma Goldman's, but I think that there's something to knowing about how someone could live in such tremendous torment
and still give something remarkable to the world. I think that that gives a lot of strength to any of us who suffer through our own issues of daily life and love and all these, the underside of anybody's public or work life. And I also think that it's important to think about how much, what our overlay is, how much we expect, how much we understand about human nature and the world in terms of balancing out the depth of our disappointment.
I guess I felt a case history was in front of me, in a sense. I mean, in the same way that one may read Freud or any other psychoanalysis that's presenting a case history, that it gave me that kind of response because of the repetition of the letters to Ben. They portrayed an obsession that was uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, somebody said to me, they said, oh, Candace, in the middle of this book, I suddenly felt like I was in a sticky relationship, and it made me uncomfortable. Like, oh, no, that's just what it feels like. I don't want to feel it. And it was interesting to me that many of the men who have reviewed my book have said a little bit too much purple passion here, whereas a lot of the women who have read it have felt a little uncomfortable but somehow took it somewhere because there were so many resonances. Emma Goldman wrote in 1911 to Ben Reitman, "Lover, hobo, you are like anarchism to me. The more I struggle for it, the further it grows from me. The more I struggle for your love, your devotion, the further away it seems from me. Yet struggle I must, for like liberty, you are the highest goal to me, the most precious treasure, dear, dear Ben. Well, are not all great things merely in the ideal? Thus my ideal of love will die with me, never to be realized. Perhaps it is well it should be so. A nice mess my love for you has made of me, a complete dependent for life's joy on a mere man. I feel like kicking myself all over. Oh, hobo dear, I am an idiot."
Toward the end of the book, you mention how, as Emma became estranged from men, that she started identifying more with feminists. What do you think? I mean, it just seems like an incredibly complex feminism that she possessed, if she in fact possessed it. Would you call her a feminist, and how would you define that as her role, in respect to her role?
I would call Emma Goldman a feminist, although the women of her time thought of her as a man's woman, somebody who was not a suffragist, who was not in any way for any special privileges for women. The Emma Goldman spoke always of a kind of equality, but a heightened humanity of men and women together. The parts of Emma Goldman's public contribution to feminism is that she spoke about issues that were very much just below the surface in a very repressive time, a post-Victorian time, just early progressive era, when these issues of love and marriage and jealousy and prostitution and birth control and longings for community and certain kind of freedoms were in the air, but it wasn't exactly being felt in the ways that it seemed to be promised. And Emma Goldman gave voice to very private issues in the public light. And these were issues about women's freedom, about women in the workforce, about wage slavery, that she was able to articulate the discontent and the longing for something other was very important, and I think a tremendous contribution to feminism.
Many of the letters between Emma Goldman and her women friends are contained in Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman. Almeda Sperry's letters, however, show a deeper pathos than letters written by other women friends.
because Almeida was very much in love with Emma Goldman and very much tormented by that and tormented by her own life. She was somebody who was married to a man who was abusive to her. It seems that she was a prostitute as well, and someone who had gotten a sense of respect for herself from a lecture that Emma had given on prostitution, on white slave traffic. And she was just entranced with the fact that Emma Goldman had great affection for her and great sympathy for her situation in life. And I think that Emma was genuinely attracted to and most likely consummated a sexual relationship with Almeida Sperry, although I should say that we have no letters of Emma Goldman's to Almeida Sperry, only Almeida's letters to Emma.
Mm-hmm.
Almeida's letters are sometimes full of longings to hurt Emma,
yeah,
as well. Very graphic images of lashing out at her and hurting the person who she loved. It's a kind of an artifact of one form, one expression of love that love takes.
What would you say are you trying to show the reader?
What I was trying to do in the book was talk about a woman with a vision but also many illusions. And the point of the book was not to drop the visions, but to drop the illusions and keep the vision. Like, how do we do that in this world in which one's expectations and hopes so rarely meet what the reality is, and how do you keep struggling for a better world, and how do you keep living your own life and relationships with people and maintain. And I think that there was something very profound to be drawn from Emma Goldman, whose heart and vision and imagination was really so all-encompassing that there's a lot to draw from her on this level after many years of people drawing so much from her on the other level as the undaunted leader of women.
You've been listening to an interview with Candace Falk, the director of the Emma Goldman Papers and author of the book Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman. The interview was conducted in 1985. From the Vault is a weekly series produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. For information on how to purchase a copy of this program or any of the archived materials we used, go online at www.fromthevaultradio.org.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.